One of the examples of excellence we want to look at tonight is William Carey, the father of modern missions. You'll notice our correspondence program, our distance learning Bible program, is the William Carey Bible Institute. Why? You'll see why tonight. It's impossible. It cannot be done. Don't be ridiculous. What difference can one person make? Have you ever encountered those kinds of reactions? Anyone who embarks on any challenging enterprise, especially those determined to end legal abortions, or to eradicate pornography, or to establish a Christian school, or Christian teacher training college, or to stop the ongoing slave trade in, for example, Sudan, or work for national reformation and revival, or evangelize a Muslim nation, any of us trying to do something like that will encounter those people who seem to believe they have a gift of criticism and a ministry of discouragement. This isn't the right thing to do, this isn't the right way to do it, this isn't the right time, you're not the right person to do it. They've just got this ministry of discouragement. So, first question is, should Christians be involved in politics or socio-political issues? I used to say we shouldn't be involved in anything to do with it. Now, we still have in our Frontline Fellowship Handbook, as part of our constitution, that missionary staff should not be involved in party politics. I don't belong to a political party, and as far as I know, none of the members of our mission belong to political parties, because while we must vote, we don't believe it would be right, it would be a conflict of interest if we were also involved in party politics. That's not to say we can't speak to political issues, but the question isn't, should missionaries be involved in politics? The question is, can Christians be involved in politics? There are those who maintain that Christians shouldn't even be involved in any social issues at all. When you tell them of the abortion holocaust or the pornography plague, you hear them muttering, all we can do is pray. Or just preach the gospel. Or it's a sign of the last days. You come across those reactions? We suspect that such attitudes are often motivated more by laziness and cowardice or a selfish desire to shirk responsibility and hard work than anything else. Certainly those people who resort to such superficial excuses are being disobedient to the clear commands of Scripture. Look at these scriptures. How can these not have socio-political implications? Love your neighbor as yourself. What about my unborn neighbor? What about my neighbor living across the border in Zimbabwe? What about my young neighbor who is being targeted by pornographers and pimps and human trafficking? What does love my neighbor mean? Go and do likewise, Jesus said. You can't walk by on the other side of the road while somebody is bleeding in the gutter and say, I'm not called to that kind of ministry. Our Lord heavily attacked the scribes and the priests and the Pharisees for walking by on the other side of the road. There's a good sermon illustration of this man who stood up in a church service one day and said, you know the message of this parable of the Good Samaritan. It's relevant today. Why, just this week I was on my way to a luncheon engagement, and on the way I saw a man bleeding in the gutter, and people walking by on both sides of the road. Nobody was stopping. Nobody was helping. And you know, he said with rising indignation, when I came back from lunch an hour later, he was still there. No one had helped him. Yeah, it's easy to say, why does somebody not do something about this? But what we could be saying is, what can I do about this? Go and do likewise. What about Proverbs 31 verse 8? Speak up for those who cannot speak for themselves. There are many who can't speak for themselves, like unborn babies, like the persecuted church, somebody locked up in a prison cell in the middle of North Korea or South, out there in Saudi Arabia. They can't speak for themselves. Rescue those being led away to death. Now, there are some people being sentenced to death in Pakistan just for witnessing for Christ, what they call blasphemy. There's a 14-year-old girl who was put on trial for life recently in Pakistan. We need to speak up for those who can speak themselves and rescue those being led away to death. What about those mothers who are walking into the abortion, like at Mary Stokes, with pregnant, and they're going to have an abortion? Is that not someone being led away to death? You are the salt of the earth. You are the light of the world. How do we interpret these scriptures without having social and political implications? What about make disciples, teach obedience to all things that I've commanded you? Or anyone then who knows the good he ought to do and does not do it sins. So sin is not just sins of commission, but sins of omission. Now, Church of England members know about the distinction because we actually have this in the liturgy to pray for the Lord to forgive our sins of omission and our sins of commission. Now, many people think of sins as just bad things I did. But in fact, the emphasis of the Lord in the Day of Judgment is on good things we failed to do. You didn't feed the starving. You didn't visit those in prison for their faith. You didn't care for the sick. You didn't care. Depart from me, cursed in the lake of fire, prepared for the devil and his angels. The Lord in Matthew 25 does not describe the Day of Judgment in terms of you smoked, you drank, you did drugs, you gambled, depart from me, cursed. I mean, those things are bad, but the Lord's putting the Day of Judgment more in terms of the good things we failed to do. Those who maintain that Christians should not be involved in social or political issues actually are displaying the ignorance of both the Bible and church history. Over 70% of the Bible deals with social, political, and national issues. Abraham used military force to rescue Lot and his family from the four kings. God raised up Joseph to be prime minister of Egypt. By the way, have you ever thought Abraham had these more than 300 servants who he could suddenly mobilize into a force to go and fight? Why? Because they weren't just caring for a sheep and camels.
No, they were trained.
They were trained to know how to fight. So that when the time came, they could defeat the four kings and their armies. Now, citizen militia, you could call it. God raised Joseph up to be prime minister of Egypt. Joseph's one of the most exemplary characters in the Old Testament. He gets an enormous amount of space in the book of Genesis. And Joseph was called to a political role. And there's no suggestion he did anything wrong in that. Samuel, Nathan, Elisha, Isaiah, Ezra, in fact, almost all of the prophets were heavily involved in political issues as advisors to kings, exerting a godly influence in national affairs, frequently speaking about national sins and calling people to national repentance. Moses, Elijah, Jeremiah, John the Baptist, they publicly confronted and rebuked wicked rulers. King David is described as a man after God's own heart. Daniel and Mordecai became governors in pagan Babylonian and Persian governments, yet without compromise. I know politics is dirty, because there are dirty people in politics. But that doesn't mean Christians can't be in there. For example, can you ever have a responsible parent saying, don't change those nappies, they're dirty? Well, of course the nappies need to be changed because they are dirty. And governments need to be changed often and frequently for the same reason. Yes, they're dirty. Change them. God raised up Deborah and Queen Esther to national leadership positions. Joshua, Gideon, Nehemiah also had senior political positions. Can a person who's read the Bible say you can't be involved in social and political issues? What do they think all of these issues are? These are the greatest names in the Bible. I looked for a man among them who would build up the wall and stand before me in the gap on behalf of the land so that I would not have to destroy it. The Lord is looking for a man to stand before him in the gap. And often he can't find one, so then he chooses a woman, like Deborah, because the men were a bunch of wimps. And in fact, the finest British Prime Minister of the 20th century was Margaret Thatcher, I'm convinced. Why? She is the best man in Britain. I mean, the men were failures, they were useless, and the strongest leader Britain got, the most consistently principled leader they could find, was Margaret Thatcher. And I'm sure it was God's will to have had a man, first and foremost. But if you won't find a man, you'll choose a woman to do the job that a man should have done.
Yeah.
Like Deborah.
Doing the
job. Yes, and that's why God gave the glory not to the general Barak, but to a woman. Jael nailed Sisera. Example of body piercing in the Bible. When Jael nailed the enemy Sisera to the floor of tent of the tent peg, as you remember. Yeah. So that's biblical body piercing. Those who maintain that Christians should not be involved in political and social issues are not only ignoring the word of God, they're also showing the ignorance of church history. Before the advent of Christianity, every culture practiced slavery and human sacrifice. The Western world loves the Roman Empire. They think they're the greatest. But the Roman Empire had abortion, infanticide, the abandonment of unwanted babies. You could throw them to the wolves, literally, legally. Throwing them to the wolves comes from the practice of the Romans to take unwanted babies and leave them outside the city walls where the wolves would come to them. And that's how Rome was even founded. By twins abandoned by their mother that a wolf had compassion on and brought up. And there have been cases of kids thrown to the wolves out in India, brought up by the wolves. There's literally, a Jungle Book's just a story based on what has actually happened. They found kids of 11 and 12 years old who'd been brought up entirely by wolves, who ran on their forehands and so on, and they made sounds like wolves and all this. They were completely integrated in the wolf pack. You think of a wolf and you think of wolf's bad, but here's wolf mothers who had more maternal instinct than the actual biological human mother of those kids. Roman Empire was bad. The Aztec Empire in Mexico and the Inca Empire in Peru and the Mayan Empire in Central America engaged in slavery, ritual rapes, mass human sacrifices. Slaves were marched up the stairs of the pyramid like temples to have their beating hearts ripped out one by one. There were over 80,000 human skulls on the skull racks of just one of Montezuma's many temples. And they want to whinge and whine about Cortez invading this ancient civilization. Oh, give us a break. It wasn't a civilization, it was a debauched, evil situation that needed to be judged. Only the advent of Christianity introduced a respect for the sanctity of life and ended the rampant infanticide and human sacrifice. In the same way, slavery was eradicated as a result of the tireless efforts of Christians like William Wilberforce and Dr. David Livingston. The whole concept of charity was a Christian innovation, as were hospitals. Hence, the healing symbol of a cross represents hospitals, not a crescent moon, not a star, not a hammer and sickle. I mean, the symbol of a cross is a red cross. Now, I know they're trying to change it. I don't know if you've noticed, there's even an attempt now to put H for hospitals, whereas H has always been for helicopter landing pads. And now they're trying to get away from the cross, and especially a red cross. They're trying a few other different options. Let's try green cross, blue cross, something other than a cross. But have you noticed even the symbol for the paramedics and ambulances? The serpent around the stake, which is pointing back to Exodus. Moses lifted up the serpent on the stake, and Jesus being symbolized by this. And so they can't get away from it. Hospitals invented by Christianity. But, of course, these monumental achievements were not easily achieved. Every victory for life and liberty was only accomplished by a lot of sacrifice and ingenuity over many, many years of hard work. And if you sometimes feel overwhelmed by the immensity of the task before you, whatever that task is, if you're discouraged by the seemingly never-ending series of obstacles and opposition, frustrations and failures, take heart. The man whom God used to launch the modern missionary movement faced all this and much, much more. William Carey was undereducated. He didn't even finish junior school. He was underfunded. He launched this mission on something like £13. He was underestimated. They didn't think there was any chance of this cobbler from nowhere in England. I mean, what difference can he make? He is undereducated, underfunded, underestimated. He seemed to have everything brought against him. He was brought up in abject poverty. He never had the benefit of high school. But William carried a thirst for knowledge. He read widely. He had a keen interest in nature. Carey's formal education ended in junior school, yet by age 12 he had taught himself Latin. This is his home. You can see a thatched roof, very humble little home in England. But then he went on to master on his own, without the benefit of formal education, Greek, Hebrew, French and Dutch, and Danish and a whole lot of other languages too. He eventually became professor of Bengali, Sanskrit and Marathi. And the British, who banned his missionary work, soon were employing him to be the professor at the prestigious Fort William College in Calcutta, where all the civil servants of India were trained. This is a man who the British despised and hated, but after one of there's nobody who knows the Oriental languages better. He's the most qualified man to teach. This is a man who hadn't finished junior school. He became a professor of Oriental languages. William Carey and his co-workers, William Ward and Joshua and Hannah Marshman, started over 100 Christian schools in their lifetime. They had over 8,000 Indians, the children of all caste, boys and girls, by the way. He launched the first Christian college in Asia at Serampore. And this college continues to this day, the Serampore College, with thousands of students. William Carey finally translated, he succeeded in translating the entire Bible into six languages. The New Testament Gospels into another 29 languages. This guy had a gift of tongues. I mean, has there ever been anybody more gifted in languages who has accomplished more in Bible translation than William Carey? And Carey's achievements are all the more astounding when you consider that his bold project to plant the gospel amongst the Hindus in India was completely illegal. Not just by Indian law, but by British law. By an act of British Parliament, it was illegal for any missionary to work in India without the permission of the British East India Company, who had really said, there's no way they're going to allow any missionaries in there, because that's going to upset their business. For the first 20 years, Carey's mission to India had to be carried out with ingenuity and circumspection, based under Danish protection in the very small Danish colony of Serampore. And the Danish king, Frederick VI, and his queen were protectors and friends of William Carey, enabled him to carry out his work because the British wouldn't allow him to do it, and so they allowed him to put his base in Danish territory. At last, the British Parliament, under pressure from evangelical members of Parliament like William Wilberforce, reversed its policy and compelled the British East India Company to allow missionaries in India, but that was after 20 years of William Carey working surreptitiously and illegally. We've sometimes been criticized for smuggling Bibles and doing illegal missionary work. And I've said, do you know anything about missionary history? All missions was illegal at first, because religious freedom is a fruit of Christianity. So before the gospel triumphs in a country, it's always illegal. I mean, that's the fact of history. How do you think missions got launched? Do you know anything about William Carey? And, you know, people who are saying, oh, but you can't do missions in a country if they don't allow it. We wouldn't have any missions, and in fact, we wouldn't even be Christians. How do you think the Bible got translated in English? It was illegal in England. The Bible translator who translated the Bible into English, William Tyndale, whose picture you'll see as you go out the door each day, he was burned at the stake for the crime of translating the Bible into English, and the first Bibles in English had to be printed in Germany and smuggled in bales of cotton into England. And they were all burned. The entire first shipment of over 5,000 Bibles, more like 6,000, were destroyed on order of the Bishop of London. His Bibles in English were illegal in England at that time. Sometimes William Carey's students saw him in tears while teaching geography. He'd point to place in the map and say, and these are pagans, they don't even know the Lord. William Carey was considered radical in his day. He boycotted sugar because he was so intensely opposed to slavery, and sugar from the West Indies was produced for slave labor. So he wouldn't have sugar. Carey also took the extremely unpopular stand of supporting the American War of Independence against Britain. Now, bearing in mind, he was a British citizen, and this is during the time of the American War of Independence that he lived. So he was considered a serious radical. You don't support the Crown's case against the colonists in America. He said, well, they've got every right to their chartered rights as Englishmen. Plainly, Parliament's not applying the Magna Carta. They've got their rights, and they're not being given the same rights that the Magna Carta guarantees. So he was a brave man. He was also subjected to vicious criticism and gossip. Under the extreme heat and in the abject poverty, and initially they lived with daily dangers with snakes and crocodiles and tigers in a remote mosquito-ridden jungle house. His wife Dorothy went insane. She is a very simple woman. She couldn't even write her own name. In fact, in the marriage register, while Carey's signature plainly read, her signature is an X. I mean, she couldn't even write her own name. And you know, with hindsight, what was William Carey doing marrying someone who wasn't even literate? So he is this brilliant mind, and he had this very simple wife. But we mustn't judge her harshly. She would have probably just done fine in England. But under the stresses in India, she went insane. She would rant and rave about the imaginary unfaithfulness of her husband, and on several occasions she attacked him with a knife. She was diagnosed insane. She had to be physically restrained with chains for the last 12 years of her life. These days, they restrain them with drugs and subdue them. But in those days, they didn't have such drugs. They restrained the same people with chains. The Careys lost their 5-year-old son, Peter, who died of dysentery in 1794. That's a year after they'd arrived in India. Every family member suffered from malaria, dysentery, and other tropical diseases frequently. Carey's first co-worker, John Thomas, squandered all their money, bankrupted the mission, forcing William to work on a plantation to provide for his malnourished family. In the first 7 months in India, the Careys had to move home 5 times, each from a better to a worse house, a tenement, because they couldn't afford any better. Although Carey wrote home to family and mission society frequently, it was 17 months before they received the first letters. I mean, how would we feel if we didn't hear from anyone for 17 days? He got no letter for 17 months, and the first letter he got from England was from the society, the mission society, criticizing him for being swallowed up with the affairs of a merchant, because he'd been forced to do some work to stay alive, because he is getting no support. Somehow, while often sick, holding down a full-time job, a secular job, surrounded by domestic turmoil with an insane wife literally screaming from the next room, and his sons going berserk, tearing the place apart too, by the way, Carey mastered Bengali and Sanskrit, and by 1797, that's barely 5 years after he arrived there, the New Testament was translated into Bengali and ready for printing. Carey had also established several schools. He was preaching regularly in Bengali. But after 7 years of tireless toil in India, he still didn't have one single convert. Not one. How's that for feeling a failure?
Yeah.
How did William Carey manage to maintain such a productive schedule while having to endure all those crushing disappointments, the endless distractions, the undeserved criticisms, the physical ailments and the heartbreaking tragedies, especially domestic tragedies? How did he manage to persevere and to keep on keeping on without even the encouragement of one single convert to justify all his effort and all his sacrifice? To understand what motivated this most remarkable man, we need to look at what inspired him in the first place. One of the most influential sermons in church history was preached on the 31st of May, 1792 by William Carey in Northampton in England. And I've been to this very church, Carey Baptist Church in England. And this is what the town looks like today. By the way, that's the house where he launched the mission society. It's still there. And we were able to go into the very place where they literally took up the first offering and got the church and the mission rolling. Carey's sermon literally sparked the greatest century of Christian advance. It marked the entry of the English-speaking world into missions. Since that time, English speakers have made up 80% of the Protestant missionary workforce, and that is absolutely extraordinary. In the last 220 years, English speakers have been 80% of the world's missionary force. Extraordinary. It all started with William Carey. And the text of his sermon was Isaiah 54, verse 2 to 3. Enlarge the place of your tent. Let them stretch out the curtains of your dwellings. Do not spare. Lengthen your cords. Strengthen your stakes. For you shall expand to the right and to the left. And your descendants will inherit the nations and make desolate cities inhabited. And on the base of this sermon, he made a theme summarized as expect great things from God. Attempt great things for God. Yet, riveting as the sermon was, the result was initially indecision. Carey was considered an enthusiast. That's the 18th century word for fanatic. He is an embarrassment because he had a bee in his bonnet about missions. And he kept bringing up missions and the heathen and evangelization. I mean, really, couldn't he just give it a break and do what everyone else was doing? But William Carey persisted until 5 months later, 12 Reformed Baptist ministers formed the particular Calvinist Baptist Society for the Propagation of the Gospel amongst the heathen. That's the title. And their first collection from these pastors amounted to £13, 2 shillings and sixpence. With that, they launched the greatest century of missions. What inspired Carey's landmark book? An inquiry into the obligation of Christians to use means for the conversion of the heathens, in which the religious states of the different nations of the world and the successes of former undertakings and the practicality of further undertakings are considered. It's a 42-word title. It's not the snappiest title in history, but it is the most important missions book ever produced. And by the way, Operation World acknowledges it as the first attempt to give a survey of what the world missionary situation was, with statistics and so on. So in a way, Operation World is based upon this, because this is the prototype. It's a prototype everything. First prototype mission society. And by the way, William Carey has got in the book 5 sections, and the 5th section is practical, what's got to be done to launch missions. And he, on his first page of a list of what you got to take, included powder, shot, rifles, knives. So he was not expecting you to go out as a pacifist. He expected you're going into missions, take all the weapons you can. Just it's a matter of point. But this prototype pioneer mission society was inspired by his eschatology of victory. Now you may wonder, what is that? Your eschatology is your view of the end times. William Carey was a post-millennialist. He wasn't like our pre-millennialists today, our dispensationalists, to say that everything's going to get worse and worse and worse and worse, and all these things are a sign of the end, and when everything's just about to fall to pieces, Jesus is going to pull the church out of the rapture, and he's going to pour out his judgment on the world, and 7 years later, the Lord will return, and so on. He wasn't a pre-millennialist, he's a post-millennialist. He believed the Great Commission will be fulfilled before the return of Christ. And so his post-millennial view, his eschatology of victory, or Puritan hope, as some call it, believed that God, who gave us the Great Commission, would enable us to fulfill the Great Commission. The work to which God has set his hands will infallibly prosper. We only want men and money to fill this country, India, with a knowledge of Christ. We are neither working at uncertainty, nor are we afraid for the result. Christ must reign until Satan has not one inch of territory left. But time and again, in the face of crushing defeats, disappointments, diseases, disasters, Carey reiterated his unwaveringly optimistic eschatology of victory. Though the superstitions of the heathen were 1,000 times worse than they are, and the example of the Europeans 1,000 times worse, though I were deserted by all and persecuted by all, yet my faith, fixed on that sure word, would rise above all obstructions and overcome every trial, because God's cause will triumph. And Carey's faith was most certainly vindicated. The years of hard work and wholehearted sacrifice were graciously rewarded by God, and Carey's ministry literally transformed India. When Carey stepped ashore at Calcutta, 11th November 1793, India was in a terribly degraded state. If an infant was sick, it was assumed he is under the influence of an evil spirit. The custom was to expose the sick infants to the elements, perhaps hang them up in a basket to either heat or cold outside. Near Malda, Carey found the remains of a baby who had been offered as a sacrifice to be eaten alive by white ants. At the Sagar Mela, where the Ganges River flows in the sea, Carey witnessed how mothers would throw their own babies into the sea to drown or to be devoured by crocodiles. This the Hindus regard as a holy sacrifice to the Mother Ganges. Carey undertook a thorough research into the numbers and the nature and the reasons for the infanticide, and he published his reports, and he presented several petitions to the government, until in 1802 infanticide was outlawed. Now this marked the first time that the British government had ever directly interfered with religious practice in India, and it set a precedent for the abolition of other evil practices. Hinduism had an extremely low view of women. It was often stated in Hinduism, there's no salvation for a woman until she's reborn as a man. See? Reincarnation. You've got to be reborn as a man before you've got a chance of salvation. Her only hope lay in serving men in complete subjection, without any individuality. Many female babies were smothered, strangled, or drowned at birth. Girls were married as young as 4 years old under Hinduism. Widows were perceived as bad omens who had brought about the deaths of their husbands. Widows were seen as an economic liability. Bereaved widows had to shave off all their hair, remove all their jewelry, forbidden to remarry, but were required to cohabit with her deceased husband's nearest male relative. Here's a widow who's been forced to mourn for 50 years, shaving off her hair and wearing unattractive clothes. Enormous pressure was put on them to actually go into the fire. Tremendous pressure for the widow to submit to sati, or immolation, to be burned alive in a funeral pyre of her husband, and in many cases, they were forced to do it. There were times where they literally were holding them down with bamboo on all sides, so she's lying on an altar, and they're standing at the distance, people on both sides pushing the bamboo down so she couldn't get off while the flames taking over. And amongst the weaver caste, or the Kauris, widows were buried alive for the husband. So because of this Hindu practice of sati, children who just lost their father would also lose their mother. and be orphaned at the same time. I mean, this is really evil. And the Hindu practice of polygamy compounded the problem. Because a man might have many wives. On one occasion, Keary documented 33 wives burned alive on the funeral pyre of one man. On another occasion, an 11-year-old widow burned on the funeral pyre of her husband. Lepers were rejected by their families. Society rejected them. They were burned alive, believing that only a violent and fiery end could purify the body and ensure transmutation into a healthy new existence. And then euthanasia was widely practiced for those afflicted by other sicknesses, putting them out to die amongst the elements. The infirmed were regularly carried out to be left exposed to cold or heat, crocodiles, insects by the riverside. Now it's important that you know all these things. Because the amount of times you hear, you missionaries should leave the people alone, they're happy the way they are, they've got their own religion. And we had this Parliament of World Religions here in Cape Town, December 1999. And we had an obnoxious Hindu professor telling us, it is wrong to ever criticize any culture. Every culture is right, and every culture is right. Every missionary is wrong when they try to change cultures, and missionaries shouldn't go, and there shouldn't be any missionaries, and we shouldn't ever try to get people to change their religions. And he carried on like this in this one workshop. One of our missionaries today, and he said during the question time, was William Carey wrong to oppose widow burning in India? Silence. This man stuttered, he stammered, checked. It seemed like an age before he could get any answer out. And in the end, his answer was amazing. I couldn't believe that he said it. He said, well, widow burning didn't influence that many people. Well, a few hundred thousand, maybe a few million over thousands of years. How can you be so callous? It didn't influence that. One is too many. For goodness sakes. But this happened hundreds of thousands of times. How on earth can someone come up with such a callous response? But that was a professor who professed himself to be wise and definitely was a fool. Carey fought against all of these and many other evils, including child prostitution, slavery, and the caste system. He publicly criticized the government for inaction and passivity in the face of murder. He organized public debates. He spoke out against and wrote often on these atrocities. And they all met with official indifference. The Indian Supreme Court in 1805 ruled sati had religious sanction and therefore cannot be questioned. By the way, when I put out this article first as part of a Christian Action magazine, I got a response from some good friends who are evangelical missionaries who said, why did William Carey waste his time getting involved in these social and political issues? He should have concentrated on his missionary work. And I said, is there ever a person in the history of the world who's translated the Bible into more languages than William Carey? Has anyone done more? And the schools. And how can you say he didn't do enough? He did more than anyone else. You see, this is important to know. How far do we take a gospel application? Do we deal with these social evils, or do we just preach the gospel in the narrowest definition? Well, let's keep looking at William Carey's life. Carey established the first newspaper ever printed in an Oriental language, the Shamkar Darpan, an English language newspaper called Friends of India, which is still being published, by the way. Carey pioneered mass communication in India. The first mass communication in India ever was done by missionary William Carey. He also launched the social reform movement because he believed above all forms of truth and faith, Christianity seeks free discussion. We are not afraid of discussion and debate. We welcome it. Carey was the first man to stand up against the brutal murders and widespread oppression of women through female infanticide, through child marriage, through polygamy, through enforced female illiteracy, through widow burning, through forced euthanasia, and all these other evils. He conducted systematic research, published his writings, raised public protest in both Bengal and in England. He educated and influenced a whole generation of civil servants through his lectures at Fort William College. He was not just teaching them Oriental languages, you can be sure. He was putting through morals and biblical principles. Serampore College and the Baptist Mission Press. He fought against the idea that a woman's life ceases to be valuable after her husband dies. He undermined the oppression and exploitation of women by providing women with education, which is a first in Asia, not just India. He opened the first schools for girls ever over there. Education was a major emphasis of his mission. In 1800, Carey was invited to lecture on Bengali, Sanskrit, Marathi at Fort William College. In 1806, they made him a professor, which is quite ironic, considering not only was he illegal as a missionary there at that time by English law, but he hadn't even finished junior school. And here he was lecturing in this prestigious college. In 1818, he and his colleagues launched Serampore College. Look at this lovely emblem of Serampore College. And notice the emblem of a phoenix. This bird that feeds her young from her own blood, because she has nothing else to give them. And the open Bible and the cross, but that's not just any cross, that looks like the Crusader crosses of Knights of St. John. And he taught theology, botany, zoology, Sanskrit, Arabic, and English literature. Those are the first languages. And you'll see just now why zoology and botany. Magnificent college and incredible impact. Here you can see the command of King Frederick VI of Denmark, by the grace of God, King of Denmark, who declares that William Carey and his colleagues, the inhabitants of the town of Serampore in Bengal, being desirous of founding a college to promote piety and learning, particularly amongst the native Christian population of India, have to secure this object, erected suitable buildings, and purchased and collected suitable books, maps, and have humbly besought us to grant them and such persons as shall be elected by them in their success to form the council of the college, hereafter named our Royal Charter of Incorporation, and carries on here. This is the king's edict granting him all the powers and authority to launch this first Christian college in Asia. Praise God for a Christian king of Denmark who's doing what, unfortunately, the king of England was not doing at that time. It was Carey's relentless battle against Sati for 25 years which finally led to the famous edict in 1829 which banned widow burning, which is even called Carey's edict to this day. Carey was also the first man who led the campaign against the burning of lepers. He campaigned for humane treatment of leprosy patients and ended the practice of burning them alive. Carey had a comprehensive view of the fulfillment of the Great Commission, to whom the Great Commission is ministering to body, mind, and spirit. He introduced ideas of savings banks. Why would a missionary be involved in savings banks? So that the poor people would have a way of being able to build a house for themselves, own some property, by lending systems of saving banks. He made investment, industry, commerce, and economic development possible to uplift the people of India. He did more than a government of India did to do this. He founded the Agricultural Horticultural Society in the 1820s. Notice, this is 30 years before the Royal Agricultural Society was established in England. He wasn't just the first in Asia, he was even ahead of England on this. He introduced the steam engine to India. He pioneered the idea of lending libraries in India. Why? Spread knowledge to raise the consciousness of the people on all these issues. He persuaded his friends in England to ship out tons of books to regenerate and reform India. And by the way, when I read that years ago, I started writing to friends of mine who are authors in America and Europe to donate books for us to distribute in Africa. This has led over the years to more and more shipments from boxes, mail sacks, pallets, to now 17-ton, 20-foot containers. And Frank has distributed over 100 tons of Bibles and books in the last year, free distribution of Bibles and books and Sunday school materials all over Southern and Central Africa. So this project that we're involved in here was inspired by me saying, Carey did this, let's see, I know a few authors overseas, let's write them, see what can come of this. And what a great idea. He said, in fact, the way Carey put it is, the British government is shipping over ammunition and weapons to India in order to keep the people under control. It would be better if they were shipping out knowledge and the gospel of Christ to uplift these people. And so he didn't just curse the darkness, he lit a candle. William Carey also introduced the study of astronomy into India. I mean, you're probably thinking, this is impossible. How can any one person do so much in one lifetime? But this is the truth. This is just extraordinary. I don't have any example to compare with William Carey. He saw that the prevalent astrology of Asia, with its fatalism, its superstitious fears, its inability to manage time, had terribly destructive consequences. They didn't even have a concept of differentiating between a past and a future. Their language had the same words for the past as for the future. There was no, because such a cycle, that how can you plan for the future if you can't even distinguish between the future and the past? Hinduism, astrology makes us subjects. You know, people read the stars in the paper, your stars say, so 1/12 of the world's population is going to have this happen to them because when they were born, you know. I mean, what nonsense. Our lives are determined by the stars. Nope. He said that our lives are determined by the one who made the stars. The Christian science of astronomy sets us free to be rulers. Astrology is superstition. Astronomy is science. Astronomy enables us to devise calendars, identify directions, study geography, and to better plan our lives and work. The stars are there to enable us to take dominion over the earth, be more productive. William Carey was the first man in India to write essays on forestry. 50 years before the government made its first attempts at forestry conservation, Carey was already practicing conservation, planting and cultivating timber. He looked ahead to when there could be a... He felt bad that he had to chop down trees for paper. He wanted to be sure he's planting more trees than he's chopping down. And he thought way ahead. He understood God has made man responsible for the earth. We're meant to make the world better. William Carey was a botanist who cultivated beautiful gardens like the Serampore Gardens and Calcutta Botanical Gardens. In fact, Melissa, you should take note of this, because he had to wear a big broad hat. He wanted to be a gardener in England when he was smaller, and he was told, you can never be a gardener in England, you've got such fair skin. You cannot be a gardener in England. You've got to stay indoors, you can't be outdoors. So he goes out and he's a missionary in India. Instead of, but he never lost his love for gardens and for plants, for nature. And so even today you can go, one of the most spectacular gardens in all of India will be the Serampore Gardens, which he planted. He frequently lectured on science, botany, and zoology because he says, all thy works praise thee, O Lord. He says, nature is worthy of study because God made it. Carey pointed out, even the insects are worthy of our attention. They're not souls in bondage. They're creatures with a God-given purpose. The Indians are thinking, my grandmother could be an insect. He's saying, no, they're not souls in bondage, but we should study them because they're fascinating and they've got a lot to teach us. The Bible says, look to the ant. The ant's got a work ethic to teach us. William Carey is also the father of print technology in India. He introduced the science of printing, built what was then the largest printing press in all of India. He devised the fonts. He had to. There were no fonts in existence for the Hindi language Sanskrit style. In 1812, a devastating fire destroyed his warehouse with his printing presses, his paper stock and his manuscripts, representing years of work, all up in smoke. He at that time was actually lecturing at Fort William College, and so he came back, and in fact it was even worse than that, because not only had this fire started, and had one building that had everything under one roof, printing press, study, library, everything, it was just disastrous. But the fire was brought under control, and some Indian, trying to be helpful, walked around opening up all the windows to clear the air, and of course the worst thing you can do with a fire is to introduce more oxygen, because a fire consists of fuel, heat, and oxygen. So you introduce more oxygen, you feed the fire. If you knock out the oxygen, the fire can't breathe and dies. So, for example, if you shut a door, a shut door can delay a fire by at least 20 minutes. But if every door in a big building is open, the whole building can burn down in under 20 minutes. So that's the problem. He had one roof, one big building, and when they opened the windows, what the fire that had been stopped, restart and destroyed everything. Even in the face of this catastrophe, Carey praised God that no lives had been lost, and he quoted Psalm 46, "Be still and know that I am God." He resolved to do better translations than the ones that were now ashes, and he consoled himself, "Every branch that bears fruit, he pruneth it, that it might bring forth more fruit. The Lord has laid me low, that I might look more simply to him. However vexing it may be, a road the second time travelled is usually taken with more confidence and with more ease than the first." He quoted Isaiah 61 and trusted God for better printing presses, more accurate translations, a phoenix rising out of the ashes. Not only was Kerry hit by the fire, but deaths in each one of the missionary families at Tsarampo, every family lost someone. Kerry himself just buried a grandson. Kerry also had to endure unjust, unbalanced criticisms from the new missionaries who actually split from the Tsarampo mission, and slanderous accusations from the mission side in England, none of whom had ever met him. He went out the field and he stayed in the field for 42 years and he died in India and he's buried in India. Never went back to England. So the Mission Society, a generation later, didn't even know him. They'd never even met him. And they had these people who failed and came back and, Kerry is terrible and horrible and slave driver and whatever. And they decided to believe all the people who'd given up. And they didn't even know the man in the field anymore. And so, do you know, he actually got kicked out of the Mission Society he had started. Because they said he was too harsh and hard and unfair. They were hit with an earthquake. They even faced a flood. One of his sons, Felix, caused much embarrassment when he backslid, adopted a lavish lifestyle, and began drinking heavily. Ultimately, however, Felix did come back to the Lord, and he became fully committed to the mission. But that would have been a tremendous strain and torment for him at the time. Yet, despite all the controversies and the calamities and the conflicts, William Carey's monumental achievements outshine all his critics. He was a dedicated Christian, whom God used in extraordinary ways to launch the greatest century of missionary advance, to translate the scriptures into more languages than any other translator in history, and to save literally millions of lives by his compassionate social action and his tireless labors. Here, the Indian government produced the 6-rupee postal stamp on the 200th anniversary of the arrival of William Carey in India. Look how they honored him. The Tsarampo College education, Christian education, and his translation of the Bible. I don't think the English government printed a stamp to remember Kerry for his 20th anniversary, but the Indian government did. That's amazing. He excelled as a missionary strategist. He was humble. He was hardworking. He was industrious. He was persistent. He was persevering. For over 41 years, without a single furlough, he persevered in the field. By the way, at one point a person asked him how he had managed, and he said, "I can plod. Everything I've achieved has been by plodding." He wasn't a brilliant man, he said. But it looks to me like he's pretty brilliant, but he said he's just a plodder. Like the tortoise and the hare. The hare can go faster, but the tortoise still beat him because the hare went down this line and stopped him. Just to show you how humble he was, at one point some rich lady at some event they were having there, she looked down the nose of him while he's professor at the Tsarampo College. "Mr. Carey, I believe that you were a shoemaker in England." He said, "No, ma'am, I was just a cobbler." Now, a shoemaker makes shoes, a cobbler just repairs shoes. So she tried to put him down. "I believe that you were a shoemaker." "No, ma'am, I was just a cobbler." How can you embarrass a person who's that humble? He brings it even lower. She must have felt like he had just slapped her face with a wet fish. We need to follow his example by ministering to body, mind, and spirit, and by persevering through all disappointments and opposition. You will get disappointments. You will get opposition in missions. It's inevitable. It's part of your job description. But you can keep going because of an unshakable faith in God's sovereign power. Here you can see the newspaper story about the death of Reverend Dr. William Carey. He said, "When I'm gone, don't talk about Dr. Carey. Speak about Dr. Carey's God." Here you can see the first day cover of the William Carey Bicentennial stamp, which came from the Indian government. And look what they're doing. This is the Indian government, the steam train, Tsarampo College, the mission printing press, Suti that he fought, all the legislation, all the different translations and books, and saving fence, forestry. The government is recognizing how much came from this one missionary. Here's another one from Bangalore. The light of knowledge coming from the open book. And here you can see Department of Post in India, their brochure explaining the symbolism of the stamps. Here's the Carey Baptist Church, founded 1st of January 1809 by William Carey, Joshua Marshman, William Ward, placed in January 2009, the 200th anniversary of the establishing of this church, as a testimony to God's providence and the faithfulness of his people in proclaiming the good news of Jesus Christ from this place uninterruptedly for 200 years. Wow. Here's the printing press some years ago, still there in Calcutta. Here's some of the Serampore College graduates some years back. Serampore College not that long ago, Serampore College today. And this isn't the only college William Carey's inspired. There's a William Carey International University in California. There's a lot of change that have come to India. I've put a chapter on William Carey, the father of modern missions, in the Greatest Century of Missions. Also, what I've mentioned tonight is all in Victorious Christians Who Changed the World. 32 character studies in this one book, which is now also available as an e-book. And for those who want the audio in Heroes of the Faith, we've got a chapter audio and MP3 as well on William Carey. This is one of the finest introductory books to it, the Heroes of the Faith one. I like this book so much. I ordered 100 copies for Christian Liberty Books, and I think they might still have a few. There are other books that are in our library here on William Carey, including cartoon strip types, interesting books. Christian History Magazine, you see that brown box, it's got a whole lot of Christian History Magazines there. It includes the one on William Carey, which is in a more magazine format. Any Great Commission course must look at the Father of Modern Missions. So, any questions or comments? You should get both this PowerPoint and audio of this in the data CD that you'll get at the end. There would also be some articles on William Carey on the web. Any questions, comments?
It's amazing how much one man obedient to God can accomplish.
With so little on his side.
Subsequent missionaries that have gone out, even to India, there have been greats like Emmy Carmichael and others. If I just think of what one man has been able to accomplish, it's phenomenal.
It's an encouragement because, you know, we might think, you know, I don't have enough education. Well, I've got more than William Carey had when he started. I don't have much funding. I've got more than he had. There's so many obstacles. Well, he had more obstacles. And, you know, you can just go through and say, God who enabled him to keep going there, he can provide for and enable us, and he can use us. I don't think anyone looking at William Carey at the beginning would have thought he had a snowball's chance of getting anything accomplished like he did, because he wasn't the most educated, well-funded and supported, well-connected person in England. Who would have thought he would have succeeded?
I think it just goes to show how important your motivation is. What exactly is your motivation? Your motivation is right. You're prosperous. You're doing it for God, for His glory. His glory, ultimately. And it's easy to just say, even in the ministry, to say, well, I'll do this and that, but it's something that you want to do, and it's something that you feel comfortable with. Like John Colton just wanted to be an academic. That's what he wanted to do. And that's what he felt comfortable with, and he thought that's what he was good at. But he was challenged.
Now, seriously challenged, rebuked, threatened.
I think that's important, because God is your focus, and the glory of God is your focus, and your self is not God.
Yeah. But notice again, different people used for missions. I mean, tomorrow night we look at Hudson Taylor, the greatest name in faith missions, international faith missions in China. But very different from William Carey, very different from David Livingston. I mean, God doesn't have a mold. He's used very different types of personalities. Mary Slessor, again, very different. C.T. Studd, extremely different. So just to also see that God does not have a mold. He loves variety. As you see nature amongst animals, well, God loves variety amongst his servants too. It isn't that all missionaries have to look like this and be exactly in this mold. This man is not your average at all. And I would have thought, of all the characters, I would have thought of someone like the most likely person to be the father of modern missions. I might have chosen someone like C.T. Studd or Hudson Taylor. But They were the ones who launched the modern missionary movement, which was William Carey. Probably the humblest of all of them in terms of origin and background and education. But he's the one who launched the greatest century of missions. Yes?
You said, you mentioned yesterday or last night about the actual four different languages that was major in his area and that. Mm-hmm. So he actually influenced his world through that.
Yes.
Like Portuguese was French, English, right. Swahili, and another one is...
English, French, Portuguese, Arabic.
Arabic. In the same way that he used those and he actually influenced mm-hmm. he even produced a Bible in it.
Yes.
I wonder how many hours of time in sleep did he have.
That he couldn't have had that much. He must have been very productive. But imagine you've got this house, which is small, with these kind of like almost paper thin walls, you know, bamboo and so on. And kids are going berserk, and wife's going berserk, and he's somehow learning these languages and translating the Bible in this incredibly difficult environment. By the way, you know who the first missionaries from America were? First cross-cultural missionaries? Adoniram and Ann Judson. They were sent out by the Congregational Church of America. They first landed in Calcutta before going to Burma. Burma was their goal. But they had to visit the pioneer missionary of all missions. So they stopped in at Serampore. And they were so... on the way, Adoniram Judson and Judson were arguing the whole way out. They got married just before getting on the ship. They were arguing the whole way out on the honeymoon on the ship over baptism. And Adoniram Judson is becoming convinced that, you know, infant baptism is not the way to go, and he's believing baptism. His wife's horrified because she comes from, you know, congregational of congregationals, and we've just been sent out to the first missionaries of the Congregational Church in America, and they hold to infant baptism. How can we do this? They get to Serampore, and they asked William Carey to baptize them, and William Carey baptized Adoniram and Ann Judson. And so their first report back to their mission society was resignation. That's a pretty rough way to begin your first cross-cultural missions, is, you know, you resigned to the society that just sent you out. And but William Carey then wrote to some Baptist contacts who found Baptist contacts in America, and the Baptists in America adopted them while they were en route to Burma. Bizarre. But anyway, that's just an anecdote of the kind of strange things that can go on in the mission field.
Also shows the courage of your convictions.
Yes. I mean, that's got to be really embarrassing. Your first missionary sent out, first missionary ever sent out from America anywhere, and they've changed denominations before they've arrived in the field. Yeah. That's about it. It did. I think it took, William Carey was, I think it was 5 months by ship for him. And he stopped in Cape Town on the way. He was only in Cape Town once as he's coming around on the way, and he said, "This is the best place for a mission conference. We need to have a mission conference planned here." And he tried to campaign for 1810. As I said, on top of the mountain, he is 200 years ahead of his time. But it's happened. Good. Any other comments?
You know, William Carey ever tried to teach his wife how to read and write?
I don't. I do know that she was very, very, very difficult. She had a fit when he wanted to go to the field. And she's a very, very simple woman. And shame, if she had been left in England, she would have probably done just fine. But he set sail without it. And there's a problem with the ship, and they returned to shore. And so he had some time, he went back, and in the interim, co-worker, Thomas, this Dr. Thomas, talked him into coming, which with hindsight was not a good move, not for either of them. But again, here's a question. In the light of Focus on the Family and James Dobson's emphasis these days, should he have gone to the field with a wife who obviously wasn't suitable for the mission field? Should she have stayed behind England? Is this the consequence of a bad marriage choice, which just plagued him for years afterwards? William Carey does not give us an example of a brilliant home life. Although, after his first wife died, Dorothy, he married a brilliant, highly intelligent, academic Danish noblewoman who was a great asset to the mission and to him, and was the academic equal that he could at last have someone he could interact with who actually understood him. Yes, Dorothy thought he was an insane fanatic, and she never shared his vision for anything.
When did William Carey start becoming academic, if I could put it that way, because you said he didn't finish schooling?
Yes, but that was because he couldn't afford it. It was just a financial thing. I think he always loved books.
Because by 12 he had learned Latin, so...
His father was a pastor Latin. And a school teacher. And now, he was a pastor and a school teacher. Now, he needed to teach at school to fund himself because he didn't get enough money from his congregation because they were so poor. But that wasn't enough, so he had to cobble shoes as well. So here's a man who's... his burdens of being a pastor, he's got a vocation as being a teacher, but he's getting his money from mending shoes.
The father.
So he's always had a...
And his father too, but he went the same way. Okay. He also taught and he pastored and he cobbled shoes.
So he always had an active academic mind growing up. It wasn't just something that sparked up.
His father was academically inclined. His father was a teacher. His father was the village teacher.
Did he translate those Bibles in those languages from the Greek and Hebrew original text?
He understood Greek and Hebrew. He taught himself Danish, which was critical. He knew Danish before he went out there. And he that just gave him the entrance into the Danish governor's palace and so on. And because he interacted with them so much, they became his protectors. But it was, he's a linguist. So when people talk about the gift of tongues, I immediately think of William Carey. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, it's not babbling nonsense that nobody understands. A real gift of tongues is an ability to acquire languages for the communication of the gospel. And this is biblical tongues of a high order.
And then also you look at Livingston, same thing.
Yes, very gifted linguist. Yeah. Now, language is key because remember, God spoke to us in our language. He became one of us in it. So we need to communicate the gospel language people understand.